This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and it's primary election day here in the Commonwealth. Secretary of State Bill Galvin, who's also on the ballot himself, expects some 1.1 million voters to cast ballots. And this is several key statewide offices, including governor. WBUR reporter Walter Wuthman has been braving the rain and covering the action at the polls this morning since early. Walt, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Hi, Tiziana.
Oh, well, I love the rain in the background. I'm sure you don't, where you're standing.
No, I'm pretty dry, but I'll say my feet are wet.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining us. You've been out since 7 a.m. this morning. Where are you right now?
Right now, I'm in front of Saugus High School. I've visited a few locations around Saugus, all through the rain, which has not let up.
And are people showing up?
You know, it seems low turnout. Secretary of State Bill Galvin, as you said, has predicted lower turnout this year than the last primary cycle. And this is not scientific, but this seems to be playing out on the ground as well.
So tell us.
Go. I have found a few people to speak with. Here's Paul Curley Jr., who I caught up with right when the polls opened at 7 o'clock this morning. He's a Republican, and he said he came out with a single purpose.
Get some of the old people out. The ones that have been there too long.
Who's been there too long?
90% of them.
So he said he was unhappy with things like deteriorating infrastructure around where he lives, and he wants to see some new faces in some of the major state offices.
So a motivated voter there. Hats off to him for braving the rain today. I do want to talk about the governor's race for a minute, Walt. So just for the rundown for listeners, Maura Healey is running basically unopposed on the Democrat side because State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz, while on the ballot, halted her campaigning back in July. Then you've got former State Representative Jeff Deal versus businessman Chris Doty on the Republican side. Are people turning out because they want to vote in that race?
Yes, this is what I'm definitely hearing the most about this morning. Here's a little bit of my conversation with Lori Butts. She's an independent voter here in Saugus, and she says she's really worried about which Republican candidate ends up on the ballot in November.
I want to make sure that the candidate that is backed by former President Trump, Deal, is not on the ballot. That's my major concern right now.
So she didn't tell me who she voted for, but the implication was that she voted for Rentham businessman Chris Doty.
And did you get a chance to speak with somebody who was there to cast their vote for Deal?
Many, actually. Here's one. Here's Republican Linda Helene. She also lives in Saugus.
I only know him through correspondence on the computer, and I just found that he was personable, and he said all the right things, and yeah.
And a kind of a theme or pattern I'm hearing from Deal voters is that they're really unhappy with the direction in Washington. They don't like President Biden or his administration. They're unhappy with inflation, with immigration, and they see voting for a Trump-endorsed Republican candidate in Massachusetts as sort of a protest against the Democratic administration in Washington.
So, Walt, as you go around the state today, we know that there are regional differences in the races people are paying attention to, what their politics are, et cetera. I'm curious, as you've been in Saugus this morning, what about the issues? What issues have energized people the most?
Yeah, immigration is one, inflation is one. Here's Lori Butts again, the independent voter. This was what was on her mind.
Housing crisis, housing costs. Is definitely one of the biggest issues that we have today.
Related to housing, I've heard about infrastructure. I've heard about gas prices, which are still quite high, although they are falling, as well as climate and climate change.
So what's the vibe been at the polling places? What's it been like, Walt? Are people excited? Are they slogging? What are you hearing?
Like I said, it is slow, but the people I talk to seem quite motivated. Some people because they're really excited about a candidate like Jeff Deal, and others because they say, you know, voting is my civic and democratic right. And every time I have a chance to vote, even if it's raining on a Tuesday morning, I need to come out and do it.
Now, we've noted that it's a different thing now than it used to be, Walt, because we really have an election season. People have had the chance to vote early. Do we know how many have cast their ballots?
We do. The latest data from the Secretary of State's office show that over 300,000 people have cast early votes, either by mail or at an in-person early voting location.
And where are you headed next, Walt? Who are you going to talk to?
I'm going to go back down to Boston, and I'm hoping to talk to some people about the Suffolk County District Attorney's race, which I don't have to tell you has been very, very controversial, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with that today.
All right, that is WBUR's Walter Wuthman. I'm sure you'll hear more of his reporting later on today on WBUR. We'll continue to follow the polls, which close at 8 p.m. tonight, and you can get more primary election coverage at WBUR.org. Walt, stay as dry as you can. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And how about this rain? With drought warnings and flood warnings only a few days apart, if you're one of those confused by the weather and the warnings, we get it. So here to talk us through, meteorologist Danielle Noyes. Danielle, welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Tiziana.
So it's really rainy out, but we're in a drought. Is that still the case, Danielle?
It is absolutely the case. It's always a little, you know, funny when we get pouring rain events when we're in a drought scenario, right? Because like a lot of folks, even my neighbors around town are like, oh, finally some rain, which is good, but we are absolutely not out of the drought yet. For example, Boston is still 10 inches in a deficit for the year so far. February was the only month we had above normal precipitation. So believe it or not, I know you've heard about the flooding reports, particularly out of like Providence and Cranston, where they had 9, 10, 11 inches of rain over the last couple of days. Boston still hasn't even had an inch. We're at like just over 3/4 of an inch of rain from this event.
So yeah, I was thinking about this, Danielle. I have some hanging baskets, right? And if one of them's really dry, I have to pour the water in slowly, because if I don't, it's so wet that the water just comes through the bottom. Is that part of what we're seeing with the flooding that we're seeing now?
Part of it, definitely. I mean, the ground is just so dry. My lawn is as crispy as crisp can be. And yes, and you're totally right about that. The ground just can't handle this much water at once. So, you know, for the city of Boston, the 3/4 of an inch has been okay. But for some of the cities and towns that have seen, you know, several inches, the ground just can't handle it. Then our drains can't handle it. And it doesn't soak in, you know, appropriately. So it's almost like we need a steady, light rain for days on end to kind of really put a good dent in this drought. Don't get me wrong, this rain is certainly helping, but we're still in a significant deficit.
So any hope of that steady rain event happening?
Well, you know, listen, yesterday and today definitely helping out a little bit. The drought monitor comes out every Thursday morning. It's released and it uses data from the previous Tuesday morning to Tuesday morning. So actually, as of 8 a.m. this morning, all the rain we're getting today is not going to count for this drought monitor update. So I just want to mention that because we may not see that much improvement in this week's update, maybe a little more next week. You know, 94% of the state is still in either a severe or an extreme category for drought. So I do anticipate a little bit of improvement, but probably not much, considering there's not much additional rainfall in the forecast for the next several days.
We're talking drought and flooding with meteorologist Danielle Noyes here. I am mindful that we are almost at peak hurricane season, Danielle. What's going on there?
So, you know, I was mentioning to one of my friends earlier, she said, well, what if we get a tropical storm? Will that help? And I said, you know, obviously we don't want a direct landfalling, you know, hurricane to come to New England. But a lot of times, you know, we live in New England, so we get these, you know, pretty incredible events that end up breaking the drought. So I mention hurricane season because the climatological peak is actually this weekend. And over the past couple of weeks, we've had Earl, we've had Hurricane Danielle. So there's definitely been more action. Just something to kind of keep in the back of the mind that obviously hurricane season lasts through November. So we still have a few, you know, months to go before we're out of the woods for that. And certainly at least a close pass from even any sort of tropical system would help us out in terms of rainfall.
And has it been a mild hurricane season, Danielle?
It's been pretty quiet so far. Things are, you know, starting to get a little more active. National Hurricane Center and a lot of the hurricane experts have predicted an above average season again. They lowered their predictions just slightly as of the latest update, just because the start of the hurricane season was so quiet. But this is definitely heading into the climatological peak, and we do typically see a lot of action in September and October.
All right, last question for you, Danielle. What about leaf peeping this year?
Well, listen, I'll say a couple of things. Number one is that northern New England, so, you know, the White Mountains, the Green Mountains, the mountains of Maine, they're in an abnormally dry, to a slight drought. So they are definitely not as bad as us here in southern New England. So it's one of those things, you know, when the mountains get a lot of snow in the winter, but we have none here, you don't want to forget to go skiing still. I think the best action by far is going to be in the northern half of New England. Still a great season up there. For us here in and around the Boston area, the trees have been stressed. I don't know if you've noticed, but some of the leaves are already kind of changing color, or they're brown, similar to the lawn. They just haven't been able to get the nutrients that they need. So it will probably be a little bit of a shorter season down here in southern New England, but I still expect some really bright, vibrant colors across northern New England.
And in just a sentence, expected peak date, when do you think that'll be roughly?
Ooh, you know, typically in northern New England, it's kind of a beginning of October, and I still think we're on track for that. For us in southern New England, it's going to be very variable. Some leaves are going to drop early because they haven't had enough rain, and you know, they're already changing, and some of them are just dropping off. In other areas, like the marshy and low-lying areas and places that have been irrigated, I think we're on a typical end of October, middle to end of October stretch in terms of the peak for here in southern New England.
All right, meteorologist Danielle Noyes, always appreciate it. Thank you.
Great to talk with you. Have a good day.
You too. And let's turn now to Worcester. Worcester is in a little bit better shape than some of the other cities and towns, and I want to find out more about that. Joining us is the state and from the state's second largest city, Phil Guerin, who is Worcester's Assistant Commissioner for Water and Sewer. Hi, Phil.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Any reactions to what we just heard from meteorologist Danielle Noyes, Phil?
Well, I'll only add that historically, every time we talk about drought a lot, it rains. So we probably just need to be on your show more often. We'll be all set.
You and I can just sit here and go drought, 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 drought until it rains, right?
Yeah, that'll do it. That'll do it for us.
So, Phil, it's interesting. Worcester is surrounded by communities that are experiencing drought. You are too, but stage one, which is the lowest drought level. So first, tell us what that means. What's stage one drought for Worcester?
So in Worcester, we have our own drought management plan. It's been around since the current version has been around since 1990. We updated it during the drought of 2016. And we base our drought responses on our reservoir, how much water is in our reservoir system. We have 10 reservoirs, so we measure levels every day and we monitor those levels. And we have in our drought plan various levels. They vary during the month. So you know, what might be a concerning level in July is not going to be a concerning level in February.
Got it.
So we monitor levels, and we have our stage one, which is more of a education, trying to get people to stop wasting water. So we did hit our stage one level on August 22nd and issued our stage one alert, asking for people not to run their sprinklers between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. when a lot of the water just evaporates, and to think a lot about how they use water and to fix leaks. Those are the main things we're focusing on in a stage one.
And at a stage one, what's your reservoir at? Is my understanding is it's somewhere around 70%. Is that right?
Yes, we're 69% on September 1st. Probably got down closer to about 67% before yesterday.
And are people cooperating? We're speaking with Phil Guerin, who's Worcester's Assistant Commissioner for Water and Sewer. As you're asking people to change their behaviors, are you finding a cooperative public, Phil?
There's always people that cooperate. There's another sector of society that will never cooperate. And then there's a whole bunch of people in the middle. So we don't see a lot of lawn sprinklers going off in the middle of the day, but we do hear about them now. So, you know, oftentimes neighbors are turning in neighbors, that sort of thing. So we haven't seen a lot of that going on even before we issued the stage one alert. So we did see a bit of a downtick in consumption after we issued the stage one alert. But we can't obviously take full credit for that because we've also had a few more rainy days.
So have you been talking with your counterparts in the cities and towns around you that are experiencing a little more harsh drought? What are you hearing if you have?
Most of the towns surrounding Worcester, we actually supply water to a number of them. So they may have their own water supplies. In addition, they buy some water from us. And those we sell water to have to follow the same drought plan we implement. but they may also have state permits that dictate implementing water use restrictions. And for a lot of them, the water use restrictions have very little to do with drought and have to do with a water management permit from the state that says May 15th of every year through October, you have to implement water use restrictions of some sort. So a lot of those that have restrictions are driven by that, not so much the drought.
Sort of contractually obligated to do so, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It's just through a state law or state permit administered by DEP. There are some local communities that have water supply issues. They're either have lost wells due to contamination or are growing communities that are just up against their capacity. And capacities of every water system get a little more strained when it doesn't rain.
So, Phil, you're sounding pretty chill about the situation Worcester is in. Are you feeling confident? Are you worried about this drought? How are you feeling about it?
We're pretty confident. I mean, every time we've had these, and they're not that infrequent. We went through, in 2016, the most severe drought we had since the greatest drought ever, which was in the mid-1960s. So in 2016, we got down to about 50% capacity. Our two largest reservoirs of our 10 reservoirs, one was empty and the other was at 30%.
Wow.
So we ended up and we implemented restrictions. I think we got to a stage three level, but it just didn't rain. So we ended up buying water. We have a backup connection with the MWRA, buy water, basically coming from the Quabbin Reservoir. So we have the best backup system in the world. Because Quabbin is such a huge supply of water that it doesn't react to a drought like all of our other reservoirs do. So we can buy water from MWRA. So we have that in the back of our minds. We're not going to run out of water.
But
that costs a lot of money, too. So we don't want to spend that money if we don't have to.
All right,
but
Phil Guerin.
The weather.
Yep, we're cutting out, Phil, so I'm going to say goodbye there, but I do appreciate you joining us. Phil Guerin is Assistant Commissioner for Water and Sewer for the City of Worcester. 10 years ago, Massachusetts had a big problem, healthcare spending per capita. It was through the roof, according to data from JAMA. In 2009, the Commonwealth spent more than any other state. So state leaders passed a law aimed at curbing our costs, especially how fast they grow. One approach was a health policy commission to serve as a watchdog. The question is, has it worked 10 years later? Well, let's bring in David Seltz. He is the executive director of the Health Policy Commission, or HPC, since it was founded in 2012. David, welcome.
Hello, good morning.
So, David, has it worked? Has this commission done its job in terms of putting a downward pressure on health costs?
Well, as you said, this is a very significant challenge. It's a significant challenge facing Massachusetts residents and people, you know, across the United States, the affordability of healthcare. And policymakers here, as you said, 10 years ago, really took an innovative approach to trying to make healthcare costs a little bit more affordable, a little bit more sustainable in terms of that annual growth that we saw. And so 10 years later, what can we say? I would say the headline is that we have absolutely made some significant progress, but there is a lot of work left to do.
So take me to someone's kitchen table, David, and tell me what progress they've felt.
I think you've just highlighted the biggest challenge, which is when we look at the annual data, we can see that the annual growth in healthcare spending has moderated here in Massachusetts over the last 10 years. And in many years, we were below kind of the comparable US rate. So our growth has been lower here than in the United States generally. And that's a big reversal from the previous 10 years where healthcare costs were growing at a much higher pace than the rest of the country. The challenge, though, is how is that translating into real gains for Massachusetts residents? And on that front, I think there is absolutely more work to be done. Unfortunately, we know that nearly 50% of Massachusetts residents defer necessary health care because of the cost of health care. And that's from a survey a year ago.
So that does beg the question then, David, and we're speaking with David Seltz, who's the executive director of the Health Policy Commission 10 years after it was formed. Can we say something's working if the people that need it to be different can't feel that it's different. Do you understand my question?
Absolutely. This is the biggest challenge. And it's not enough to say, well, it would have been worse, but for the efforts we've done. And so that's why I do think we need to build off of the successes of the last 10 years. One of those successes is that we do have a lot more insight into what is driving healthcare costs. And that will allow us to be able to design strategies and policies to better and more effectively target them so that we can see those real gains for Massachusetts residents and employers.
So what is the biggest driver? What is the biggest driver of increasing healthcare costs now that you've got that data?
Well, interestingly, it is not that Massachusetts residents are using more services. It's not that we're getting more MRIs or more TC scans or more pharmacy scripts. It's the price that is being paid for each of those services. And those prices, those payments to healthcare providers have been going up at a really an uncontrollable rate. And because that's subject to negotiations between healthcare institutions and health plans, there's a lot of variation in who gets paid what for providing the exact types of services. So it's not so much that we're using more, it's the price that we're paying for the services we're getting.
And is there something that you wish you could do that you can't right now, David, that you think would allow you to deal with that problem?
I think there's two things that could help right away. One is that we need to have greater accountability for healthcare institutions and plans that are not doing their part, that are not being a part of this effort to try to bring down the healthcare cost curve. We have pretty limited tools to try to have accountability for everyone to be rowing in the same direction.
And I just want to clarify what you mean is a healthcare system. You set a cap. We can't have growth in spending be more than X. And some hospital systems just blow right by that, right?
That's absolutely correct. It is not a cap. The law right now is it is a statewide target. It's something that we're all working towards together. And what we need to be able to ensure is that everyone is working towards it with the same amount of effort and rigor. And that's where our tools are limited in identifying and being able to address, you know, individual systems and health plans that could do more.
So I wonder to what extent. So we've got how much we spend, the fact that we spend more than other states, how quickly we spend more, sort of the rate of increased spending, right? And then the question of when we blow past what we'd like in the rate of increased spending. How much of this is due to the fact that we have an unusual concentration, David, of big teaching hospital systems, sort of world-renowned, powerful hospital systems?
It is absolutely a part and a strength of our healthcare system in many ways. We're home to world-class institutions. They're engines of innovation. But that comes at a very high cost. And those costs are felt and borne by families, by employers, and by taxpayers. So there needs to be a balance moving forward. And those institutions are under extreme pressures right now, but so is every family in Massachusetts. And so how do we create a long-term strategy that balances the need for a world-class healthcare institution, but one that actually people can afford?
All right. David Seltz is executive director of the Health Policy Commission put in place a decade ago to try to curb increases in healthcare costs in Massachusetts. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So here in Studio 2 for From the Newsroom, Priyanka Dayal McCluskey, who's the senior health reporter here at WBUR, brought us into this story and has been reporting on this 10-year anniversary of this effort. Priyanka, thank you for joining us.
Nice to see you again.
So let me just start by getting your, I know you talked to David for this story. Let's get your reactions to what we just heard from him.
Well, I think David gave a good overview of the situation and some of the history and the challenges that still lie ahead. And it's really important to note, I think, looking at the data is one thing, but how this affects people in their everyday lives, their family, their ability to afford their, you know, doctor's visits, you know, that's really important to keep in mind. And there can be a disconnect between what is the data showing and what are people feeling.
Yeah, and that is interesting. You know, I said to him, take me to someone's kitchen table. How have they felt the benefit? And he basically said, therein lies the rub. So tell us about where it's fallen short.
So I think the bottom line is that costs are still rising for consumers, for patients, for businesses. You know, it's very rare to see our costs go down, right? Premiums, copays, those continue to go up for people. And that's, you know, we have a high rate of people insured in this state, but it's still not, that doesn't mean that healthcare is necessarily affordable for everyone. So I talked to Amy Rosenthal, executive director of the consumer advocacy group Healthcare for All, and they run a helpline for consumers, and they're always hearing from people who are struggling to pay for healthcare.
Healthcare affordability is one of the things we hear about every single day in every single language in which we serve.
And as David mentioned, you know, there was a survey done last year showing that, you know, many people are having trouble paying for healthcare, even though they're insured, and many people are skipping care. So they find it unaffordable and they're not able to get the care that they need.
So this 10-year anniversary, Priyanka, comes at a particular moment, right? When we happen to be having a lot of inflation, costs of many things are going up. So it does make sense, I guess, if you're providing the same amount of health care, but costs are going up, then you're going to need to charge more as well. We're already worrying about cost increases. Is this going to sort of move into overdrive now?
I think that's a very real concern that people have expressed while I was reporting the story. I mean, the pandemic has also played a role here. And inflation as well. So that's affecting the rate of cost increases. It's almost a certainty that costs are going to keep rising. But the question is, how much are they going to rise, and how quickly and why? So Andrew Dreyfus is CEO of the state's largest health insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. By the way, he's stepping down from that role later this year. Here's what he said.
What's happening is that hospitals and physicians are asking health plans like Blue Cross for really substantial increases in the prices that we pay for their services. And that has me very worried, because that's what put us in this position in the first place.
So there was a period of time where costs were rising very rapidly in Massachusetts. Now that has slowed somewhat, but there's concern that could we go back to that period of really quickly rising costs.
So maybe it works for a while, then it doesn't work.
I was hearing that while reporting this story, that maybe it's time to look at new approaches or expanding the role of the Health Policy Commission, potentially.
We're talking with WBUR senior health reporter Priyanka Dayal-McCluskey, who's been covering 10 years of a move by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to make some substantial changes so that the rate at which we spend more and more every year on healthcare costs gets better. And I understand, Priyanka, is it fair to say mixed results there?
I think it's fair to say that. I mean, it so much depends on what you're using, how you're measuring this, but I think it's fair to say mixed results because, as we've been talking about, people are still paying more for care.
So what made you decide to dive into this story? Where'd it come from for you?
Well, I've been covering this since almost the beginning. So I thought it was interesting to see 10 years out, like how much progress have we made as a state? And that was just the basic question that I went in with. This was a very different kind of approach that Massachusetts took. And since this law was passed in 2012, other states have looked at this model and some have tried to replicate it in certain ways. So my question was just, you know, we tried this experiment. Has it worked or has it not worked?
So I'm curious, if you followed this almost since the law was passed, do you think where we are with the results now measures up to what the expectations were a decade ago? Falls a lot short, falls a little short, exceeds? What would you say?
I think a lot of people can point to successes and progress. And as David was saying, you know, their view of the commission is that they have made progress, but there's still work to do. So I think it really is a mixed picture.
And what are you going to follow next in this? I mean, if you've been following it for 10 years, you're probably going to keep doing so. So what will you watch for now, Priyanka?
So a lot will depend on the next legislature, the next governor, and what are their ideas and strategies that they pursue. And, there were a couple of bills that the House and Senate passed this year that didn't make it over the finish line. They expect to go back to those, looking at prescription drug prices, looking at hospital expansions and how that affects consumers in the state. So I'm interested to see, you know, what the legislature does here and also the next governor. You know, a lot will depend on them and if they want to take further steps to control healthcare costs.
All right. From the newsroom, Priyanka Dayal McCluskey has joined us, senior health reporter for WBUR. Always good to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have more coming. When we returned, October is the 10-year anniversary of Superstorm Sandy. There was actually a pirate ship that went down. We're going to talk about it and a number of other fascinating stories about sea rescues and storms and ships. It's going to be fun. Local author Michael Togas joins us. I'm Tiziana Deering. You're listening to Radio Boston.
The East Coast is being pummeled with the power of a record-breaking superstorm.
Oh my God, it's washing everything away!
Oof, that footage from ABC News, October of 2012, when Hurricane Sandy devastated a huge swath of the East Coast, including Boston. Do you remember that? I do, but what you may not remember or even know from Sandy was the incredible story of the Bounty. It was a replica tall ship that had been used in filming Mutiny on the Bounty and the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, a wooden pirate ship caught in a mammoth hurricane, 16 people on board. Local author Michael Togas is telling the story with co-author Douglas Campbell. He's the author of 5 books in the True Rescue series, books for middle grade readers on harrowing real-life adventures at the sea. The 6th book, Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy, is out later this month, but I read it. Michael's here. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. So it kind of blows my mind. It almost sounds like fiction, right? You've got this tall pirate ship. It's in the middle of a storm and the masts are sinking and it feels bigger than life. You've written a lot of stories of massive sort of crisis. I'm thinking about The Finest Hours. You wrote that with Casey Sherman, turned into a massive, big feature film. Is this an unusual story or just kind of par for the course for you with these sea rescues you read about?
This one's definitely unusual because there was ample warning that the hurricane was approaching. And yet the ship Bounty went out anyways.
So that's the nut here, right,
yes,
Michael? It's the difference between we got caught by surprise and we knew it was coming.
Exactly.
So talk about that a little bit.
Well, the captain, Robin Walbridge, was in New London, and his first mate at first was against trying to get around the storm, but the captain said, I've got experience and we can adjust as we follow the storm. And what was really interesting was when he addressed the crew, he said, nobody has to go. You could take a train and meet us in Florida. That's our ultimate destination. And everybody agreed. And in the book, I get into a little bit of that group dynamics of how you can all go down the wrong path.
And he kind of argued, listen, we'll be safer not in dock when this thing hits. Is that right?
Yeah, which is totally wrong. There's no way you're safer. The ship may be safer. It wouldn't get beat up as much. But the humans aren't.
So that's interesting. So the ship actually might get battered a little bit less further off the water, but that doesn't mean the people are safe.
Exactly.
All right. So I want to dive into this a little bit more, but I want to start because the ship itself is such a character in this true story. So the Bounty was made for a movie, for Mutiny on the Bounty, that Bounty. It was bigger, but it was a replica. It described the ship for us a little bit.
You know, basically all wood. And it was built in 1960. And it wasn't just a movie prop. It was built by true craftsmen up in Nova Scotia. So it was the real thing, but it was old. And that's a problem when you're in a storm.
So I wonder about that too, because, and this came up for me as I was reading the book, it is older, and yet we know of ships that last hundreds of years, potentially. I think about old Ironsides, and maybe not hundreds of years, but is it necessarily the case that a 50-year-old ship can't handle a hurricane?
Not necessarily, if you keep up with the maintenance closely and you make the right decisions when you're getting out there to perhaps abort the mission, which they did not do. So those two factors definitely contributed.
All right, I want to bring this home a little bit for our listeners. So the descriptions of the ship, what happened to it, the process of sinking during Hurricane Sandy, the experience of the 16 people is pretty striking. So we're going to ask you to read a little bit here. This is from your book, Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy. And I think here we've got Coast Guard rescuers flying into the hurricane to try to find the ship.
Yes, they're on two pilots, McIntosh and Myers, are on a C-130 aircraft. They're the aircraft that do the search. So I'm gonna break in right there when they're approaching the site of the ship. And remember, they're flying through a hurricane.
Not just any hurricane, Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah, the widest hurricane ever recorded, by the way. Suddenly, through a break in the clouds, the commander saw waves, large waves, some cresting at an astonishing 30 feet. But what really got his attention was that the waves were coming from all directions, as if the giant rollers were battling one another for supremacy. The night vision goggles made the scene especially eerie. The waves and the sky were a dark green, but the streaking foam and churning wave tops were bright and clearly visible, clashing and smashing into one another. McIntosh wondered how in the world any vessel, much less one taking on considerable water, could stay afloat in such chaos. Up ahead and off to the right, a beam of light rose from the ocean, and McIntosh carefully banked the plane in that direction. It was a handheld flashlight a sailor on the Bounty was shining at the aircraft. Myers, sitting in the right seat, saw the ship first, and with awe in his voice said, "There she is." The ship was out of McIntosh's line of sight, and he asked the co-pilot what it looked like. "Well," said Myers, "it looks like a big pirate ship in the middle of a hurricane."
That was local author Michael Togas reading from his upcoming book for middle grade readers, Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy. So briefly, tell us what happened to the 16 crew members.
When the ship filled with enough water, it capsized, and all 16 presumably were thrown into the sea. And I say presumably because we don't know what happened to the captain, and we don't know what happened to Claudine Christian, who was a newcomer on board and actually traced her lineage back to Fletcher Christian on the original Bounty. So they're all in the sea in the middle of the storm, and there is no helicopter on site at this point. So each person is fighting for survival.
And Captain Walbridge was never found?
Never found, and we don't know if he went down with the ship purposely, got caught in all the rigging because there's miles and miles of line on board. He had made a statement to a friend a couple years earlier, "If we're ever in that kind of trouble, they always blame the captain, so I'll go down with the ship." But we don't really know.
And Ms. Christine, unfortunately.
Yes, her body was found, but she was deceased.
You know, one of the things that strikes me in when I read your works, and one of the other works we've talked with you about in Ms. Christian, excuse me, not Ms. Christine, one of the things that we've talked to you about in the past, when we talked about Into the Blizzard, which is the big blizzard here, it's these rescues. It's the Coast Guard especially and people who operate boats and people who operate planes and helicopters and these rescue swimmers who literally ride down on a hook sometimes get dumped in these 30-foot seas. Have you learned with this new series, which you're targeting to young adults, have you learned more than you knew before about who these people are, how they work, how dangerous the role is? Talk about that a little bit.
You know, there's so many books about superheroes and wizards and everything for middle readers, but I want to talk about these true heroes who have flaws to a person. They all say, "I was afraid as can be." It would be abnormal not to be, but yet they're able to do their job in spite of the fear. And in this storm, you know, picture yourself going down into a hurricane. And when you detach from that hook as the rescue swimmer, you're alone out there. You may or may not get back in the helicopter. You may or may not reach the survivors. So I definitely learned a lot. I was never in the Coast Guard, but just spending time with these men and women who fly out there, it's something else.
So I want to talk about these middle grade readers now. And to do that, we're going to bring in another book that you've written. And that book is In Harm's Way, which is about the sinking of the USS in Indianapolis. I'm going to play a little sound here.
He was coming back from the island of Tinian Delady, just delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. 1,100 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Didn't see the first shock for about half an hour.
So some will recognize Robert Shaw as Quint, kind of a legendary salty character. And this is part of his legendary monologue from the movie Jaws, 1975. He gets some of the details wrong, but the horror is real. I mean, this is a horrible, horrible story. And you decided to write it for middle grade students. So start just briefly the sort of the, the book jacket synopsis of the Indianapolis.
Sure. Doug Stanton wrote the adult version, and that was number one on the New York Times. So he and Macmillan Publishers approached me to do the young adult version. And at first I said no, because I knew I'd be cutting up his work and condensing for middle readers and making it more fast-paced. But he said, no, I've read your others. I'm fine with what you're going to do. And true to his word, he was. He was not looking over my shoulder. So in a nutshell, the Indianapolis was going to the Philippines. It had already dropped off the atomic bomb, its secret cargo, that was referenced in the movie Jaws. And the captain was told, you know, you don't need an escort because you're in an area where we have not, you know, seen much action. There were certain things withheld from the captain that he should have been told of, one was which there was a Japanese sub in that area that had sunk a destroyer earlier.
And they didn't tell him because they wanted to protect the intelligence source, basically.
Exactly. And boy, you could, there were so many screw-ups by the Navy in this. I could go on and on. But the sub, the Japanese sub, it was a monstrous sub over 300 feet long, sinks the Indianapolis, and 300 men were probably killed, you know, from the torpedoes, but another 900 ended up in the water. And normally, you know, because they did get off an SOS, there should be rescue attempts made. In this case, they were in the water for 4 days, again, because of snafus with the Navy. So 4 days in shark-infested water, it was awful. It was horrifying.
And at the end, I know it's a little bit disputed, 316 or 317 people survived. Which number do you use?
316.
And many of them died. Okay, so we're back at this middle grade thing. Because when you read this, right, it's horrific to read people beating off sharks and having, you know, watching the guys next to them get bit in half. Mm-hmm. But that's not everything. We taught people go crazy, people die by suicide. People fight and kill each other when they hallucinate after drinking salt water. They dehydrate and die of hypothermia. I mean, it's like no end to the ways the world is trying to kill them while they're trying to hang on. What about writing that for middle graders?
Yeah, it's, you don't need to put all the gory details in, but you're not going to sugarcoat it either. You're going to say exactly what happened. And, you know, you touched on a good point that it wasn't just the sharks. That's kind of what the Indianapolis is known for. But in Harm's Way, you'll see that so many of the men, the thirst just overcame their logic. And Dr. Haynes, who is a character in the book, tells them, do not even sip the seawater.
He swims around pleading with them
right,
not to put their mouths in the water and drink this water. He pleads.
Yeah, and you know what salt water does is it dehydrates the brain. So you start to hallucinate, and men step out of the raft. They see something, maybe a bar, to go have a drink or whatever it might be, and they step right into the waiting sharks.
So one of the things that's interesting, we're talking with local author Michael Togas, who has a series of these rescue, true life rescue books for middle grade readers. We've talked about Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy. And we're talking about the story of the USS Indianapolis now. And one of the things that's interesting, you run these numbers, right? You've got less than a third, really, of people survive right at the end. On the one hand, it's a story of survival because more than 300 people survive at the end. On the other hand, it's a terrible story because more than 900, right, die.
Yes.
And then and then it gets worse because the U.S. Navy tries to cover up what happened, and they blame the captain, although the survivors argue it wasn't his fault.
Exactly. They put the blame on the captain. They say that he should have been zigzagging, but yet his orders were use your discretion to zigzag at night or not. You know, if it's a cloudy night, you may not have to. And he used his discretion, and he went straight at night. And really interesting, for the court-martial, they actually brought in the Japanese sub-commander, and he testified zigzagging would have made no difference. We had a clear shot
at the ship. So they literally brought in the enemy commander who ran the submarine that sank the Indianapolis, and he testified on behalf of the captain that they were blaming.
Exactly. He said zigzagging would not have made much of a difference. We could have sank that ship because it was so easy. And so Captain McVeigh was court-martialed. And when you think about the hundreds and hundreds of ships that went down in World War II, there were no other captains court-martialed, and yet they went after McVeigh. And it's such a sad story. And that the survivors, you would think, they'd blame the captain if anybody would, but they all rallied around him, said it wasn't his fault. This is war.
And yet many of family members who did lose people on the ship blamed him, sent him hate mail.
Yes.
And in the end, he died by suicide.
Yeah, he died by suicide. He had retired from the Navy after, of course, they stripped him of his command. He was living in Connecticut, and it became too much for him.
So it's a tough book. You write both, you know, tragedies like this, books of great heroism and inspiration. Mm-hmm. Where do you get your inspiration from?
Knowing that these people are flawed and that there can be courage. I'm not even sure some of them should be called heroes. It's an overused term. Now everybody's called a hero if you do something that's just a little bit brave.
Yeah.
But these people who go above and beyond, their resourcefulness is what really impresses me.
All right. Michael Togas is a local author, author of the True Rescue series, which includes Rescue of the Bounty, Disaster and Survival in Superstorm Sandy. We've had you on before. I read a few of the others, by the way. They're all great fun. What, six titles now in the series?
Yes. And then I did a departure and wrote a book called Claws, taking all my knowledge of the sea and doing a fictional book about a 7-foot lobster. It's kind of like Jaws, only about a lobster. And it's based off one of the men who I interviewed for Fatal Forecast that in our trap, up comes just the claw. It was 20 inches long.
Oh, my goodness. Michael Togas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And before we end, if you or a loved one are having thoughts of suicide or struggling with mental health, you can call 988 to receive support. Again, that number is 988. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Glad you joined us. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.